I'm delighted now to welcome Becky Kravitz. She's a sculptor, mask maker, and makeup artist for opera companies, and her exhibition, Love, Death, and Revenge, Opera-Inspired Sculpture, opens tomorrow evening at Tansy Contemporary Sculpture Center at 619 Canyon Road. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So you began your career as an artist and a mask maker. How did you come to that work?
I had majored in theater in college, thinking I was going to be an actress. And when I got out of college, I worked with different companies and continued my training. And within about a year, it was clear to me that that wasn't what my calling was, but I really wanted to stay in theater. So I decided to go to theater graduate school and just really focus on theater literature. So whatever it was that I ended up doing, I would just have a better background. I ended up at the Yale School of Drama, doing a master's program in theater history and criticism, which was basically literary-based studies, and found in the course of my first year in the master's program that what I was most enjoying doing was volunteering to do things with my hands, to help paint sets, make masks, sew costumes. I mean, at Yale, they do 70-some-odd productions a year, so I had lots of opportunities, and that's really what was making me the happiest.
Now, you hadn't been an artist until that point?
I had done a lot of craft work. I had a really amazing crafts training in high school. I worked with clay a lot. I did jewelry making, stained glass, silkscreen, kind of the whole variety of craft work, which has really, I've really brought that into my sculptures. I took one art class in college that was a drawing and two-dimensional design. I'm not really a two-dimensional artist, so I didn't enjoy it, and I didn't go on with my art studies. I focused on theater. And so I had this 1 year of the literature program at Yale, and by the end of that, I decided that what I really wanted to do was work with my hands, and I wasn't sure. People kept saying, oh, you should be a designer because you're so artistic, and I said, well, I don't draw. And I was looking back through the catalog, and I saw that they had an internship in prop making, which included classes in woodworking, metalworking, scenic painting, mask making. And then I could sit in on any design class that I wanted to. Some of the most extraordinary designers in the world were teaching at Yale. And I transferred out of the master's program in dramaturgy and did an internship in props, and I was elated. It brought together everything I loved: theater, working with actors, working with live theater, working with my hands, but building things, not drawing them.
Yeah.
And the class in mask making brought everything together: sculpting and makeup, which I had always liked, but I didn't realize that there was actually a career in makeup because I was used to theater, where basically actors do their own makeup. So I took that class and I said, this is it, I want to be a mask maker. And I went to New York the year after I got out of Yale and
The
rest is history. I pursued a career in mask making, and my first professional job was at Santa Fe Opera. They were actually looking for a mask maker in the summer of 87. What ended up happening in my summer at Santa Fe, where I was hired as a costume crafts person, the wig and makeup shop was right next door to the costume crafts department, and that was my first exposure to makeup on an operatic level. And I saw that because singers are often cast for their voices and not for how they look, and there are so many characters in opera that are either fantasy characters or ethnic characters, or where it requires a grand transformation, that the opera makeup artists were essentially painting masks on human faces.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about, for a moment, about masks, because the role of masks in theater and opera is sort of, it's almost counterintuitive. Like, how can you speak or sing with a mask on your head?
Well, there's kind of two answers to that question. One is that it is often the dancers or the supernumerary characters who are the ones that are wearing the masks, and certainly in the opera world. But there are operas, The Masked Ball being one of them, or Midsummer Night's Dream, where Bottom has to have a big ass head, or Marriage of Figaro has done with masks sometimes. There are operas that require masks. And I have developed techniques using materials that the singers can really see through. It's very rare that you would have a mask for a singer that was totally covering their face, because it does affect how the singer hears their voice and how their voice projects. So we try and design masks where the mouth is uncovered.
Right.
But there are materials I can use that are kind of like fabric versions of window screen, where from the audience it looks quite solid, but from the singer's perspective it's quite open. They can totally see, and there's an open space for the voice to come out.
You were talking about makeup, and you actually were Plácido Domingo's makeup artist for many years, and this whole phenomenon of transforming a singer into a new character, what is that like? What is the nature of that craft?
Magic. I mean, it certainly was an incredible joy and a privilege to be Plácido's makeup artist in Los Angeles, and both working with him and working with other singers, it's very much a collaboration. You're collaborating with the artist himself, with the designer, with the director, and everybody is coming together to create the transformation. The time in the dressing room with the singer, and what some people might not realize is that in opera, the makeup artist is there for every show. And most of the time we are doing the makeup for the singers, putting on their makeup, putting on their wigs. They are there getting into character, warming up, greeting visitors. And I've often been told by singers that watching their face be transformed in the mirror is a very big part of their getting ready to go on stage. They are watching themselves be transformed into the characters.
What are some of the materials? Like, how does it differ from theatrical makeup or getting made up to go to your wedding or something like that?
It's basically just a level of how extreme and heavy the makeup is. I mean, opera houses are large, many of them. In Europe, the opera houses are much smaller, and the makeup tends to be quite naturalistic. You could wear it as street makeup. Working at Los Angeles, where it was, you know, a couple of thousands of seats, and the faces have to read to the back row, the makeup itself is the same makeup. The foundation is heavier coverage than you would wear for street makeup, because you want to create a nice blank canvas that you can really paint on. Things like the eyeliner is quite bold. The lower liner is dropped a bit so that the eye visually is opened up more from the stage. Sometimes the eyebrows are raised a little bit to create more space between the eye and the eyebrow. It very much depends on what character you're creating, but in terms of the actual materials, theatrical makeup and opera makeup are the same. It's just a question of how big a house you're working in and how heavily you apply it.
Right, right. And I would think that it's even more complicated now with these high-definition performances where people are also, they're performing to a house and they're also performing on camera.
That has really changed the nature of our work as makeup artists, certainly in terms of the wigs that we use, because the high-quality theater and opera wigs are human hair, largely, and they have what they call a hand-tied lace front, which is what makes a wig look like it has a very natural hairline. It's very, very fine lace mesh with hairs tied in with a tiny, tiny little hook, one hair at a time, ideally following the hairline of the singer that you've got the wig on. Theater lace is heavier, and you see more of it because it disappears on stage. Film lace is cut way, 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 way back so that you don't see the lace, so that it really looks like the hair is growing right out of the head. It's a much more fragile lace. It's a more fragile wig. The front doesn't last as long. And it really has become something that makeup artists and wig masters have to deal with if your production is going to be broadcast in high def, of really thinking about how to make it look good on the screen, but also work in the theater. I know some productions, for instance, when the Metropolitan did Hansel and Gretel and the witch had a lot of prosthetic makeup, they actually hired a film prosthetic person to come in and do the prosthetics because they were used to working for close-up,
right,
high def.
Right. Oh, stuff. Very interesting. So, yeah, yeah. When you say prosthetic, I mean, you're talking about making a normal person's face into a craggy, witchy face, that kind of thing?
Well, prosthetics is when you actually are adding pieces onto the face. You're adding
a
fake nose or jowls,
okay,
which is rarely done in opera because it really having, I mean, fake noses are fairly common, but a full prosthetic addition really affects how your face feels. So
yeah,
it affects, you know, how you're singing.
How you sing.
It also takes a long time to apply. You know, you want to be as efficient as possible when you're working with a singer who has a whole lot of other things to be thinking about to go on stage to perform an opera. To do a 2-hour makeup job,
right.
It requires a lot from the singer. So that kind of thing isn't done very often.
So I was up at the Tansy Contemporary Sculpture Center yesterday looking at your work, and you have made these sculptures, a lot of them heads or busts, I guess you call it, of opera characters like Carmen and Don Giovanni and Siegmund and Sieglinde and many others. How did you start doing that?
I was originally trained as a mask maker. And then when I got into opera, I was working both as a makeup artist and a mask maker. And at that time, my mask making was strictly for theaters or operas. It was all masks that were worn on stage. And as I fell more and more in love with the opera and worked with singers creating their characters, and I really saw the singers responding directly to the music to create their characters. And my work as a makeup artist was, as I had mentioned, a collaboration between directors, designers, singers. And I really felt the need to use my artistry to respond directly to the music, and to, rather than working with whatever face I was given as a makeup artist and transforming that into the character, although that's a great deal of fun and a great challenge as a makeup artist, I was also really feeling like I wanted to create my own vision of the character that was directly responding to the music and the text. So I conceived of creating an exhibition that was all about opera characters that were not portraits of singers in a role, it was portraits of the character as I envisioned them as I listened to the music. And for me, the masks are, there's this magical element of when you give a mask to a performer and you watch them take it on stage, and the character that I've sculpted comes to life on the body under the lights. So it always felt like something on the inner surface of the mask was kind of this magical transformation place, that the actor wearing the mask or the singer wearing the mask was becoming the character, and that transformation was sort of happening on that inside surface. That was like the membrane of where there, things were happening. So I started out, when I started doing this, coming up with this idea of doing a whole show of opera character faces, I started out by just collaging and painting and using bits of music on the inside surface of the mask to sort of talk about that transformation point. And as I worked on the show, and I went to the Los Angeles Opera and I said, I have this idea for an exhibition, can I mount it here? And they were very enthusiastic and supportive about that. So I started planning a year and a half in advance for my first show of opera characters. And I realized that it would be really exciting to actually create a little stage set on the inside of the mask, in the same way that a set designer presents their idea for a production. So I started creating a whole three-dimensional world inside the mask face, not just text and collage on the inner surface. And that moved me into working in bronze as opposed to working in mask-making materials, because bronze allowed me, because I could weld little support systems inside, I could really create an interesting three-dimensional structure inside the face of the mask. So that's how the whole series evolved. And it started with just masks, with interior tableaus, and then I started adding necks and shoulders and little bits of costume.
Right, and they're so fascinating because, I mean, you look at this. First of all, I would like to present the challenge to our opera buffs in the audience to go up to the exhibition and look at the heads without knowing who the characters are and figure out who is who.
Mm-hmm.
The Carmen is pretty hard to miss. And some of the others, like Don Giovanni, I looked at that face and it's like, he is such a Don Giovanni.
Thank you.
in all of that kind of compelling but mean-spirited at the same time. And did you use models for them? Did it come from your fantasy of that archetype?
I very rarely use models, partly because I have a vision in my head of what the character looks like, and I would be hard-pressed to come up with an individual who matches what's in my head. I actually did have a model for Carmen. She was someone that was in a class that my husband was teaching, and he actually came home and he said, I found your Carmen.
Yeah. And he was absolutely right. She was Latin American.
She was a real mix. I mean, she kind of had that gypsy mix of lots of different cultures coming together in her. And she had the look. She had the eyes of the hair, the attitude.
The attitude. That's so much of what it is in that character and in many of the characters. And I really encourage people to go because it was so, these characters are so expressive and beautiful and they're so real. You feel like you're walking into a room of people that you've sort of known, but they're not in size, but in their being, they're a little larger than life.
It's something I work really hard at with my sculpture, and I think it very much has to do with my theatrical and operatic background, is I always want the viewer to feel like you've walked in on a moment.
Yeah.
That it's not just a portrait of a person, that it's a person captured in a very specific moment of thought. And I can spend literally days just on the eyes, where the eyes are looking, what the subtlety of expression is going on, you know, with the muscles and the skin around the eyes, and the same with the mouth. I mean, I'm really pleased to hear you have that response to the work, because that is the key thing for me, is to capture a very specific moment of emotion.
It's interesting that you say that, because I remember once going to an exhibition of early 20th century paintings and seeing a painting that captured a moment, and it was more like a photograph than any 19th century painting I'd ever seen. And I realized that photography gave visual artists the ability to even think about capturing that moment. Mm. And I didn't think about it when I was up there, but in a way, that moment that, you know, a 60th of a second captures, you're doing that too. But I want to talk about the stuff that's behind the face. So like in the Carmen, it's on a pedestal that can be turned, and you turn it around, and inside there are the three tarot cards from the opera that Carmen has read. And those are on the inside of the... It's not a mask, but
She's a bust, yeah.
She's a bust, but it's a hollow bust. And there's a sculpture of the composer Verdi, and on the inside of that, it's like an interactive wheel that turns. Tell us about that.
The Verdi sculpture is actually called Verdi Dreams, which can be either read as dreams that Verdi is having or Verdi is dreaming. And it is an actual stage, a proscenium stage in the back, that you can turn a little key, and behind a parted curtain you see images from six different operas that I chose out of the vast repertoire that I could have chosen from Verdi's operas. And as you turn the key, different characters and scenes come up on a wheel that's running in the stage, and the inside back of his head is all painted like a sky and clouds, so it is very much kind of almost a surrealistic dreamscape of the inside of the head. And there's tiny little bits of music on each of the images that come up behind the stage and the titles of the characters. And the Carmen you were mentioning that has the tarot cards, because Carmen reads the cards. And she has an aria about how she reads the cards all the time. And for her, death is always the card that comes up.
Right, right, right.
So I did a death card, and then I did a lover's card. But the lover's card appears upside down. Because as I was researching, I didn't know anything about tarot readings going in, but I did a lot of research about it. And they said if the lover's card comes up upside down and you're reading, it means disastrous love affairs.
So right.
That seemed really appropriate.
Right, right. Now, you were talking before about how you started working in bronze, which obviously is not a traditional mask material. Tell us more about that.
As I was evolving this idea of doing the interior tableaus, and my theatrical mask work was moving more into fine art, it just made sense to me to look at casting in bronze. I don't do the casting myself. I take my original sculpture to a foundry, and they do all the technical aspects of turning my clay sculpture into a bronze. But once I started doing it, it was thrilling. You know, you're creating something that's going to last thousands and thousands of years, and because it's metal and it's welded, it opened up a huge number of possibilities of how to do things that appear to be floating or you can do things sculpturally that I can't do in other materials just because of the nature that is welded metal, and it has incredible strength even in very thin structures.
So are you still doing opera makeup? Are you still involved with opera companies?
I am. I have, since I left, I was with Los Angeles Opera for about 22 years, and I left LA to focus more on my sculpture career, and have been living quite rurally ever since. I was in rural southern Arizona for several years, and now my husband and I live in a town of 900 people in western Massachusetts. And I found, after just a couple of years of focusing exclusively on sculpture, that I really missed the opera a lot. I missed my colleagues, I missed the music, I missed working backstage, and just the whole world of it, which I quite love and had been a huge part of my life for so many years. So I actually have found, to my great delight, some smaller opera companies that don't have resident makeup artists and will bring me in just to run a show. So I do all the advanced preparation from home. I order the wigs, actually from the woman who was the wig master in Santa Fe when I first worked in Santa Fe, who has a company in San Francisco. And then I will go on site. I work in at Opera Roanoke in Virginia. I actually, the day after my show opens here, I fly to Opera Fairbanks up in Alaska, and I'll be on site just for a week or a week and a half, and we just dive in and do all the dress rehearsals and all the performances in that one tight little time, which is definitely not how it's done at a company like Santa Fe or LA or the Met. They have much longer spaced out rehearsal processes. So yes, I maybe have about 5 or 6 weeks of opera work during the year, and I love that. It feels like it gave me back something that I really missed when I was focusing more on my sculpture, which is where I wanted to be focusing, but I wanted to have both worlds, and now I do again.
And now you do. When you're doing an opera as a makeup artist, I mean, you don't just like do it and go home. Presumably they get sweaty and you have to fix it after act one or
After and during. I am always off stage when my singers come off stage. I know where they're exiting. I am there with a cough drop, with a powder puff, with lip gloss if they need it, and that's part of the job. The dresser and I are a team. We are there to handle if a tiny little bit of a mustache is coming unglued. I have a very elaborate pocket system in my apron with everything I could need, hairpins and spirit gum and tissues, and so I am there to do touch ups, quick changes. Sometimes a singer comes off stage and then they have to go on again very quickly with a costume change or a wig change. The singer will come off and they will just stand still with their arms outstretched, and sometimes there's as many as 4 or 5 people working on them.
Because you just have to, change everything really fast.
Change everything really fast. And the singer can just, if they just stand still, we can all do it for them. And they, somebody's buttoning up the back and somebody else is changing the cuffs, and I'm taking a wig off and putting a wig on.
Amazing.
And yeah, it's exciting. It's the first dress rehearsal, it always feels like a train wreck. You feel like, I'm never going to get this done. We have so little time and so many things to do. And miraculously, always by the third dress rehearsal, the final dress, it's like, wow, well, that was easy. you get the timing down, you get your routine down, and it becomes almost like a little choreographed routine.
Becky Kravitz is a sculptor, mask maker, and makeup artist for opera companies. Her exhibition is called Love, Death, and Revenge, Opera-Inspired Sculpture. It opens at 5 tomorrow evening at Tansy Contemporary Sculpture Center at 619 Canyon Road. And I encourage people also not only to show up, but to look at the website, which is BK Sculpture Studio. That's your website, Becky. And there's other bodies of work that have nothing to do with opera that are also really interesting. We don't have time to talk about it right now, but there's a series about witnesses, and you don't know what they're witnessing, which is absolutely fascinating. So people can look at that. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and look forward to seeing you tomorrow night.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a delight to be here.